radioactive soda, mascara that makes you go blind, and good old-fashioned botulism. There are lots of good reasons to regulate how food and drugs are sold. Consumer protection advocates drove the formation of the government agencies and laws intended to protect us from snake oil and death. But how far have food laws gone in the name of protection? Our guest today says too far, that bad food laws are edging out small producers and mandating production models that just don't make sense. He makes the case in his book, Biting the Hand That Feeds Us, how fewer, smarter laws would make our food system more sustainable. He's an attorney and a university professor and founder of the nonprofit Keep Food Legal. Baylen Linnekin, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, so before we dig into the food laws that you say we could chuck out, could you give us an idea of the history here? How did the regulation of edibles on today's scale begin in the United States?
That's a great question. Food has been regulated since the earliest time in this country, and it ramped up beginning in the start of the last century, in the early 1900s, after the publication of The Jungle, Upton Sinclair's novel, which exposed some really hideous conditions in the slaughterhouses and stockyards in Chicago. And after that, we got the law that led to the formation, ultimately, of the Food and Drug Administration at the federal level. We got the Federal Meat Inspection Act, which requires USDA inspectors to be on site whenever food meat products are being processed. And, over the decades, the ensuing decades, we've seen an increase in regulations. Now, I should absolutely lead with the fact that I believe in food safety and food safety regulation. I believe in inspection. I believe in testing to make sure that we're not getting food that has salmonella and E. coli and other harmful or deadly bacteria in them. But we've moved well beyond that to what I detail in the book now. As a whole host of rules that aren't making us or our food safer, that are creating mountains of food waste and other problems that, for advocates of sustainable food, I think have proven to be an outrage.
And you lay out that case in great detail in your book, Biting the Hand That Feeds Us. I want to circle back, though, to kind of where this began and mention the publication of The Jungle. Again, many of these regulations are actually born out of journalism and out of the exposure of conditions that are pretty horrifying, like those that Upton Sinclair wrote about. But your book also opens with a case from the meat industry, talking about how meat regulations affected a small producer of salumi. I would say salami, maybe because I'm giving away the kind of salami that I didn't have access to. But could you tell us more about that gentleman's experience trying to produce meat in this day and age, 2016 or 2015, whenever it was, coming out of that history of meat kind of being the driver of these sorts of regulations?
Sure. So the case concerns a gentleman named Mark Denitas, who taught for a decade at Johnson & Wales, which is one of the leading culinary institutions in this country. He taught food safety and meat cutting. He served on the American Lamb Board. And he started only after a decade of working at Johnson & Wales. He started a small salumi, as you mentioned, salami, pepperoni, that sort of meat. And he sourced all of his meat from Cure Organic Farms, which raises heritage breed pigs and has, I think, 100 different certified organic fruits and vegetables that it sells within a 50-mile radius of the farm. He got his salt from an ancient seabed in Utah. He told me back in 2012, he only used a few ingredients. It was good meat, quality spices, and time, T-I-M-E, and that was pretty much it.
No nitrates or nitrites or preservatives that we usually see in store-bought salami.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And so he was doing this very successfully, and again, as I mentioned, USDA inspectors must be on site whenever meat like that is being processed or animals slaughtered. And so, he was inspected. He passed all his inspections. There was never any evidence whatsoever of any harmful bacteria in his food. He won awards from the Colorado Restaurant Association and Eater. Bravo, the network that airs Top Chef, referred to him as the, quote, sausage king. And the Denver Post said that he had made Denver a special place for old world meats. And it's interesting because his company, Il Mondo Vecchio, he's first generation Italian American, actually means, you know, translates in Italian to the old world. And so he used these old world methods while complying with new world regulations to produce safe and award-winning food. However, the USDA one day decided that Donatus would have to add nitrates or nitrites to his food in order to continue to sell. They ordered him to stop selling his food. Again, there was no reason, no public health or food safety issue. They just decided one day that they didn't like his methods anymore.
And adding nitrates or nitrites, that wasn't the only option available to him, but it sounds like the other option also wasn't something he wanted to do.
Yeah, the other option was untenable. It was he would have to pay to conduct a challenge study to prove to the USDA that his methods were safe. And again, he was using methods that, you know, people have used since they started you know, curing and aging meat. And this challenge study, these studies have no certainty of success, and cost several thousand dollars, more than $10,000, and could take years. All the while, he wasn't allowed to sell his food, so he'd be, you know, essentially running the company into debt in order to try to prove to the USDA what their own testing had shown already, which is that his food was safe.
And so how does this story end for Mark Donatus and his artisanal salumi in Colorado?
I love happy endings, but this is not a happy ending.
Nope.
The regulators essentially gave him those choices, you know, do a challenge study or add nitrates and nitrites. And he said, you know, he told me several years ago, I'm not going to lie to my customers. I can't call my company Il Mondo Vecchio, the old world, while using these new world methods. And so he chose to go out of business rather than to, again, in his words, lie to his customers.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Balin Linekin. He's the author of Biting the Hand That Feeds Us. It talks about food laws that Balin says we could chuck out and would actually make our food system more sustainable. You're welcome to join this discussion, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Balin, one of the things that you point out, and using a case like what happened with Mark Donatus and the salumi in Colorado, is that regulating a process rather than the results can be problematic, especially for small food producers. But, I mean, if you're regulating results, you're kind of already too late once you catch it. You've already got a salmonella outbreak, or you've already got bad products out there that have made it to the market or ruined someone. So it's really not realistic to test or certify every product. How do we move forward without taking two steps backward, you know, to Upton Sinclair's The Jungle in terms of safety?
Well, I mean, certainly there are, you know, inspectors who are on site can point to and should point to unsanitary conditions, say, in a, you know, if Donatus were, and he certainly wasn't, but if he were picking up his food off the ground and then making food with it, then the inspector should absolutely halt him in that case. But if you're demanding inspections, which I think, you know, is definitely a smart thing and something the government should do, and testing, you know, you have to demonstrate that your food is actually safe, that it doesn't contain bacteria, then I think that's the best way to go about things. And as we see, even, you know, people who are following the USDA-mandated process or FDA-mandated process, you know, if you go to the USDA or the FDA's website, these people who are following the government's mandated process oftentimes are the ones whose food actually contains salmonella, contains E. coli. And so,
why,
you know,
do you think
these
that
processes,
is?
Because I think that, you know, inspection is imperfect, and following a process is not, you know, as anyone who's baked knows, you know, following a particular set of steps is not necessarily a guarantor of the outcome you want. I made souffle with some friends the other night, and souffle is the, you know, the classic example of the food that, despite, you know, your sort of best efforts at following the steps very, very closely, may not turn out exactly how you want it. But the proof, they say, is, you know, in the pudding. Mm-hmm. And so I think the inspection makes the most sense. And letting people like Donatus make food in safe ways while using their own traditional methods or innovative methods as a far smarter way to go, and also one that allows and embraces sort of different levels of food. Small producers, as you I think alluded to, can't necessarily buy these costly machines and whatnot, and hire people to do their paperwork and whatnot. And I think that requiring good outcomes is always a smarter way to go.
Yeah, you touched on something there. You make the case that regulations, especially USDA regulations, that's the U.S. Department of Agriculture, they tend to favor large producers. Could you tell us more about that and what arguments support that idea? We've seen, that, of course, the case of Mark Donidas, but, on a greater scale.
So, I can give another example, and the book's full of examples that illustrate my points. But in Mississippi, there's a requirement for farmers markets that says if you're going to sell meat at a farmers market, that you need to own or lease a refrigerated truck, bring the meat in the truck to the farmers market, have the truck running throughout the farmers market, and only sell the meat from the back of the refrigerated truck while the refrigeration is on. And, that seems at first glance perhaps to be a sensible rule, but if you're a farmer who's selling, half a dozen steaks, to have to buy a truck or lease a truck and drive it, some distance and have it running the whole time is absolutely cost prohibitive. And that's why, based on what I've heard, that there's very little meat being sold at farmers markets in Mississippi. And, so what's an alternative? An ice chest. Put
right.
your meat in that, keep it cool, and put a thermometer in there. So on the outcome, the government can require you to keep your meat chilled below 40 degrees Fahrenheit, which is the danger zone, the temperature at which bacteria can start to grow. But the government shouldn't care whether you're using a refrigerated truck, which may be great for a large producer or seller, or an ice chest, as long as you're making sure that the temperature is at or below the danger zone.
And sticking with sanitation laws for a minute, this reminds me, latex gloves, they're kind of as ubiquitous in restaurants now as they are in hospitals. They give a lot of people peace of mind when you think about it. There's so many pathogens and nasty little germs that are carried by our unwashed hands. But you write in your book about when California passed a law requiring people who prepare food to wear latex gloves, and there was a major backlash. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, this is one of the few examples I give where outrage and an appeal to common sense and science actually won out. So California passed a law a few years ago that said that chefs and bartenders who were handling food, say cutting up a lime and squeezing it into a drink, had to wear latex gloves. And these are disposable gloves, and so that automatically raises the question of how much waste is that going to create in terms of latex waste. But there's also the question, and it's a good one, and it was raised by the chefs and others in California, that actually doesn't make food safer. Again, it's at first glance, it may seem that people wearing gloves are making safer food. But if you're wearing gloves and you're working with, say, raw chicken and then with salad, that would mean that you'd have to change your gloves between the time that you touch the raw chicken and the time that you touch the salad. But gloves tend to give not just chefs, but everyone, a sense of sort of invincibility. Mm-hmm. And they also can rip. People leave these gloves on, and so they're transmitting bacteria from chicken to raw salad, or there's bacteria underneath the gloves because they haven't washed their hands. And that can lead to problems and actual sickness in restaurants. And so what makes sense, and the reason that this was repealed, is that this is the same thing that we all do when we prepare food at home. We touch raw chicken. What do? We go over to the sink, we wash our hands with warm, soapy water, and then we go and touch our salad or something else. And this is, there's nothing revolutionary about this idea. This is what makes food safer at home, and this is what makes food safer in restaurants. So, most states, if not every state, already have rules in place that require hand washing. You see those signs in the restroom, staff required to wash hands before returning to the kitchen, and that's absolutely what makes food safer, and requirements like that make perfect sense. But the glove law was something that actually was going to make food less safe.
If you're just tuning in, we are talking to Balan Linneken. He's a lawyer and an author, food policy expert, talking about how we can cut the fat from our food regulations. His book is Biting the Hand That Feeds Us. I'm Emily Curitan, and we want to hear from you during this discussion. Do you own a small food business, and are regulations an issue for you? Maybe you have trouble selling what you make at farmers markets because of rules like that one in Mississippi we heard about, where you're supposed to sell meat only out of the back of a refrigerated truck. If you run your business under the table because of rules like this, now's the time to give us a call. 800-838-3760 is our phone number, or you can email us jx@jeffnet.org. And Balan, let's talk about some unintended consequences. You mentioned with the gloves, you know, how many gloves are we throwing away as a result of that? A lot of people cheered the recent decision to ban partially hydrogenated oils with trans fat in them, especially in a country like ours where so many people are dealing with nutrition-related diseases like diabetes and obesity. Yet you say this law may even have some unintended consequences. Could you talk about that some more?
Yeah, I discussed in the book the law with a guy I know who's a vice president at the Humane Society of the United States. He, Paul Shapiro, he works on farm animal welfare issues, but he had pointed out to me, in fact, that the push to ban trans fats actually is going to have a devastating consequence, and this, you know, is not immediately apparent to anyone, for the rainforest, particularly in Indonesia and Malaysia. And why is that? Because the ingredient that's going to replace trans fats mostly is palm oil, and palm oil is grown in those areas, and it's grown by chopping down rainforests. So we have now the Sumatran tiger and other endangered animals that are basically being given death sentences because of the trans fat ban by the FDA.
So we're seeing an increase in palm oil plantations as we see a decrease in the demand for hydrogenated oils like those that have been banned in the United States. That raises some interesting questions about sustainability, something that is often not addressed in food regulations. We're talking about processes for health and safety, but environmental friendliness, certainly it's a marketing technique or part of labeling, but do we see it as regulations, and does it work if it's part of regulations?
Well, sustainability isn't quite yet, particularly at the federal level, something that regulators, lawmakers consider. And in the book, I urge them to do that, to shift their focus, to find out that if, in fact, there is a more sustainable way to regulate, and that's not going to impact something dramatic such as food safety. For example, if some food is on the market and it contains some sort of undeclared allergen, like peanuts, let's say, which can, in fact, kill people, from a sustainability perspective, you'd say, oh, don't recall that. You know, that would create food waste. But from a public health and food safety perspective, which I think wins the argument in that case, then you say, recall that, because that actually could sicken or kill someone. But outside of that sort of limited consequence, I think that we should, lawmakers and regulators should begin to involve conversations about sustainability with their lawmaking. And if there is a more sustainable way to do things, or just a way to let people live more sustainably, which is really at the heart of my book, then lawmakers and regulators should absolutely do that.
And, you know, in terms of what lawmakers can do, what we're seeing now, we've seen a push for labeling laws in particular. Just this past July, Congress passed a GMO labeling law. It doesn't require producers to spell things out for you. They could have their GMO declarations in one of those little codes that you scan with your phone. But still, are there unintended consequences that you think could outweigh the benefits on laws like this pertaining to labeling?
I think the GMO labeling law is almost uniformly terrible, and I think probably we'll run into a bunch of it'll result in years of lawsuits and arguments. You point to QR codes. Who the heck uses QR codes?
Mm-hmm.
No one. And I think the other options include that. A company could put an 800 number, so when you're buying a can of refried beans at the store, you can whip your phone out and dial an 800 number and find out if it contains GMO ingredients. laws like these are ridiculous, knee-jerk responses to demand by some for no labeling and demand by others for mandatory labeling. And what we get is a pretty ineffective and absurd outcome that's not going to really benefit anyone.
And we're broadcasting right now from Jackson County, Oregon, which is actually one of few counties to ban GMO crops, having a local ordinance in effect. Zooming out, do you think that kind of a ban protects the small producers who support it or makes a better food system for the people who live here?
No. I think that the ban, and I've looked into it somewhat, is not being enforced simply because it's unenforceable. It's so expensive. It would require, I think it's hundreds of thousands of dollars to actually implement. I think that banning GMO crops is just as absurd as mandating GMO crops, and I attack farm subsidies at the federal level in the book because they're largely subsidizing things like corn and soy, which are each of them 90% or more genetically modified in this country. And I think that farmers should be free to plant whatever crops they want, whether that's conventional corn or organic corn or genetically modified corn or marijuana, frankly, for that point. I think that when you have a county or a state or a federal government that is trying to skew our food choices with subsidies or with bans, that we're less free as a society.
We're talking with Balan Lineken. He's author of Biting the Hand That Feeds Us, How Fewer, Smarter Laws Would Make Our Food System More Sustainable. We have much more to talk about with Balan, leaving off the point there on GMO regulation. We'd like for you to join this discussion. We'll have the phone number and email coming up. I'm Emily Curitan. First, we're going to take a short break on The Exchange. We'll be back in about a minute 45. Back on the Jefferson Exchange. This is the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. We're here with Balan Lineken talking about food policy and food laws that he says could go. You're welcome to join our discussion. It's 800-838-3760 to join by phone or jx@jeffnet.org to send us an email with your thoughts. So, Balan, we left off there talking about what you say, not such a great idea, GMO bans, which you say makes us less free. Farmers should be free to plant whatever they want to plant. I want to push back a little bit there, just talking about the nature of seed propagation. Here, especially in Jackson County, the main concern is about alfalfa. And, you know, especially though, like a corn crops, things that are wind pollinators, your freedom doesn't necessarily just stop at your fence line. So how do you account for that principle, you know, in terms of a legal framework to make sure that someone who doesn't want their seed banks contaminated or cross-pollinated with genetically modified organisms is free to do that as well?
That's a great question, and I'm glad you asked it. So I support the idea that if you are, say, an organic farmer and your crops are pollinated by genetically modified, let's say, corn, and you're growing organic corn, then I absolutely think you have a recourse in the courts. I think that you should be allowed to sue, and I think that that should be up to a judge and or jury to decide whether you actually have a claim and are owed money for that. I do think that that, you know, that's part of freedom is that we can turn to the courts when people have, you know, perhaps encroached on our property or people's things have encroached on our property. So I think the courts are the right recourse there rather than simply banning the GMO crops.
I'm glad you brought up the courts. Of course, you're an attorney, and you've played a small role in some major cases dealing with food policy. I really just want to say this on the radio, the Raisin Administrative Committee, which totally sounds made up, but actually it's a thing. And a key player in a Supreme Court case where you wrote a brief opposing the Raisin Administration Committee or Administrative Committee. Could you tell us about that? What is that?
Sure. So there are plenty of these programs that were set up by the USDA beginning around the New Deal era, so, you know, the 1940s, and they were intended to restrict the supply of crops like, or foods in this case, I guess, like raisins from getting into the marketplace as a way of propping up the industries. And so the Raisin Administrative Committee, even if you've never heard of it, you know it because they funded the California Raisins claymation commercials, the Heard It Through the Grapevine videos.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we know those. Yeah.
And so, you know, and everyone knows the milk mustache.
Uh-huh.
You know,
that's
milk. A similar milk thing. Beef, it's what's for dinner. Pork, the other white meat. These are government-funded advertising initiatives in which they effectively take money from producers and use it to market the products. Well, the Raisin Administrative Committee actually, you know, some of these set up quotas. For example, they say you can't produce more than X number of or pounds of milk, let's say. The Raisin Administrative Committee was set up a little differently, and it said that you actually have to give the government either raisins or money. and this made it all the way up to the Supreme Court. And late Justice Antonin Scalia said during oral arguments, which I was present at, so it's basically your raisins or your life. And it turned out that it actually was. This one gentleman, Marvin Horn, in California, who's a raisin handler, you know, he dries the raisins and sends them off to a packer. You know, he was told that he would have to give the U.S. government about a decade ago either half of his raisins or several hundred thousand dollars for the privilege of handling raisins. And he thought this was ludicrous and said that this was, you know, unconstitutional under the Fifth Amendment because the government doesn't have a right to take your property without due compensation. In fact, you know, they wanted to take his raisins or his cash.
What was the legal framework for the give us your raisins or your cash ultimatum? Was it the Food and Drug Act going all the way back to the first part of the 20th century or something more modern?
No, it's something more modern. It's from the New Deal era, and it's these administrative committees that are set up. And they're known. There's marketing orders is one type. So, you know, you don't have a choice. If you're handling raisins in California, at least up until this Supreme Court decision, you had absolutely no choice but to either give the government your raisins or the cash equivalent, and the government then uses that to do anything from throwing the raisins away to make sure that raisin prices are artificially high, or putting them in school lunches, or selling them themselves in Europe, or any number of things. They can put them in a warehouse and let them sit there. You know, for indefinitely. And the Supreme Court actually decided, rightly in this case, in favor of Horn and said, you know, the government can't just take your raisins without paying you something. Unfortunately, what they said, though, the Supreme Court, was that the government is free to establish quotas, which would have effectively done the same thing, you know, made us pay more for raisins by raising the price that uh-huh. sellers get by limiting the supply.
Mm, raising the price there. So Marvin Horn partially prevailing there in sort of sorting out the relationship between raisins and the Fifth Amendment, not something we think about a lot. What does skim milk labeling have to do with the First Amendment?
It shouldn't have anything to do with the First Amendment, really, but you're talking about a case that I worked on and discuss at some length in the book. There is a very small creamery located in the panhandle of Florida called O'Cheesy Creamery, and they have three employees. And I believe two of them are the owners, a husband and wife. And so they're a tremendously, you know, a great example of a sustainable business. They have salt licks on the farm. They raise Jersey cows, which are smaller and require less water. Again, we're talking about, you know, Florida's panhandle where it's very hot. They compost, they reuse the manure to grow food. They sell only locally to co-ops and at farmers markets. So, you know, a great example of a sustainable business, and I provide more details in the book. They were selling skim milk for several years. And again, it's, you know, it's pasteurized skim milk. They're inspected. There's never any foodborne illness issues or questions there. But one day an inspector showed up and said, "Hey, you don't add vitamin A to your skim milk." And they said, "Well, of course not. Our products are all natural. We don't add anything to our skim milk." And the inspector said, "Well, Florida defines skim milk as having added vitamin A. And if you don't add vitamin A to your skim milk, then you can't call it skim milk." And this is where the First Amendment issue arises. And they said, "Well, how about we just call it, you know, skim milk, no vitamin A added," which seemed like a reasonable compromise. And the state said, "Nope, that's not going to cut it." So what the state came up with, and I swear I'm quoting directly and I'm not making this up, the state told them that they would have to call their skim milk, quote, "non-grade A milk product, natural milk vitamins removed," end quote.
Uh-huh. So they hadn't actually removed vitamins, they just hadn't added them.
So when you remove the fat, the cream from milk, okay, the vitamin A resides in that fat. And so when you remove it, the end product has little or no vitamin A as compared to whole milk. And so the federal government and Florida, amongst other states, require you to add vitamin A. Since this milk was only being sold in Florida, the Florida regulations were what governed. And so they were forced to stop selling skim milk, sort of like Donettis, their principal. They didn't want to add anything to their milk. And so they eventually sued. They were losing thousands of dollars each week. They were wasting this milk. And it didn't seem fair that they couldn't call their skim milk, which literally only contains skim milk, skim milk. And so they went to court, and the judge actually ruled against them. It was interesting. The state of Florida told them at some point during the litigation, sort of changed their tune and said, "You know what? You don't have to call your skim milk non-grade A milk product, natural milk vitamins removed," which after all is misleading because it doesn't actually point to the fact that the milk contains no fat, for example. What you can call your skim milk is, quote, "imitation skim milk," which again is skim milk that contains nothing but skim milk. The state offered imitation skim milk. And that lawsuit is, they lost and is now on appeal.
Mm. So a bit of a bitter, another not so happy ending for the small producers, one of many you talk about in the book, Biting the Hand That Feeds Us, How Fewer Smarter Laws Would Make Our Food System More Sustainable. The author's with us. His name is Balin Linekin. You can be with us, too, here on The Exchange, 800-838-3760. We're covering a lot of terrain in the world of food, food systems, and policy here on The Exchange today. Emails also welcome, jx@jeffnet.org. Balin, I'd like to stick with milk for just a second. You mentioned, I think, one of the more extreme examples I've ever heard of it being illegal for someone to drink the milk from their own cow. But many, many places have rules about raw milk, either banning it or, like in Oregon, you have to buy a share of the actual cow. In California, most raw milk operations are still under the table, at least in rural areas where I've seen them, because it's simply just not feasible for small producers to be able to sell milk. Can you tell us more, kind of a thumbnail sketch of what are the regulations and how do they work and how are they not working so great?
They're mostly not working. So raw milk was, unpasteurized milk was common in this country up until the birth of pasteurization. And, you know, pasteurization certainly can take out the harmful bacteria from milk. And so, you know, I think I'm comfortable that that's a factual statement. But I also think that people should be allowed under the law to sell and to consume raw milk. I support the idea of a mandatory warning label letting people know that the milk that they're purchasing has not been pasteurized. But other than that, I think, as with, the ground beef that you buy at the grocery store, raw chicken, or you eat, sushi at a Japanese restaurant. You know, these are all raw foods that could, in fact, contain some sort of harmful bacteria, and some of them we consume raw. I mean, sprouts and melons are other examples of things that have sickened us in recent years. So the federal government was fine with raw milk up until 1987, when Public Citizen, which is a group that was founded by Ralph Nader, sued the FDA and forced them, because of a judge's decision, to ban the interstate shipment or sale of raw milk. So that's been the law of the land, since, for what, I guess, almost 30 years. Now, states, as you point out, you know, there's cow share agreements or herd share agreements where you can own a piece of the cow, quite literally, and that gives you a right to purchase some of its raw milk. The Wisconsin case that that you referenced, where a gentleman was told that he doesn't have the right to drink the milk from his own cow, that was the result of a judge's decision a few years ago, and that's that state permits only the quote incidental sale of raw milk, which is the most vague legal terminology imaginable, and something that's, I think, frankly, impossible for a farmer to know whether, you know, what they're doing is legal or not. Other states allow the sale of cat food or dog food. So you would, you know, go to a farmer's market and you'll see raw milk labeled as pet food.
Mm-hmm. I've seen that.
Mm-hmm. And butter. Then, of course, there are butter.
Butter.
There are other sort of. Yep. And so there are these, these sort of patchwork of state laws. And I think that, again, going back to my initial thoughts on this, states should allow the sale of raw milk, and it should just be subject to, I think, a mandatory warning label, and that's best. I don't think that the government should be promoting any dairy, along with any other food, but I think that it should permit pasteurized milk sales, raw milk sales, and let consumers make up their own minds.
I want to get, there's so many topics covered in your book, Biting the Hand That Feeds Us. I want to be sure we get to food waste. That's a big one. And you sort of zero out some non-intuitive laws that you say promote food waste. One of them is composting services. That's something I really wish often that we had where I live. My compost heap is not sort of the pride of my life by any stretch of the imagination, and I'm jealous of my friends that live in cities where they can just put it in the bucket and seal it up, and then the city hauls it off for them, and along with any guilt they might have had about throwing away food scraps, everybody feels warm and fuzzy. But you make the case that in Oakland, this kind of program actually increased food waste. How's that?
So the city had a contract restaurateurs, and this really pertains to restaurants, had a contract with a composting company in San Francisco, and that seemed to be working very well. Most of them are composting most, if not all, of their waste, their food scraps. And so Oakland went and signed a new garbage contract that forced everyone in the city to work with one trash and recycling company there. That's not inherently terrible necessarily, if I can qualify that statement anymore. But what it basically did was it made it far cheaper for these restaurants that had been composting their waste to simply throw it out to the tune of several thousand dollars a month. And so essentially the government was, deciding that it was better, for people to throw away their waste than to compost it. And so the restaurant community was outraged, and even some, Bay Area columnists who, I can't think of another place where a waste contract would have, been sort of fodder for editorial writers and columnists. But certainly the ones who had come out in favor of the this new contract realized that it was terrible and soon were vocal opponents of it.
Another element of food waste is getting food that we don't want, that's extra, like, say, leftover from school lunches, to some other people that might need it. It's especially on my mind this week, Thanksgiving, when the lucky of us get to gorge and other people don't. But there are barriers to getting food to people who need it. Could you tell us about those?
I think the most odious example that I describe in the book is really of any food law at the federal, state, or local level. Or a series of municipal laws around the country in cities And I can think of three right off the bat in Texas. There's San Antonio, Dallas, and Houston, so really big cities. New York City, Philadelphia, Orlando, Fort Lauderdale, Las Vegas. You know, many big cities around the country have prohibited people from sharing food with the homeless and those in need. And people in Orlando, for example, members of the group Food Not Bombs, have actually been arrested for the, and I'm using finger quotes here, crime, sharing food with people in a public park.
I'm going to cut in. We're losing you to a bad echo, and we're about to the end of our time. Thanks so much for being a guest of The Exchange to talk about your book, Biting the Hand That Feeds Us. Baylen Linekin, I really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Emily.